If you have brothers or sisters, you know that the relationships we have with our siblings, good or bad, are powerful. And they are the relationships that are most constant throughout our lives. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The nature versus nurture debate has largely been settled. Genes and environment both matter and they interact. But when scientists focused their research on nurture and the relationships between caregivers and children, there was a powerful force they weren't counting on. Siblings. Today, through science, psychology, and anecdotes, we'll explore our emotional and genetic connections, birth order, twins, and only children. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Most of us have siblings, and many of us have or are raising a set of siblings. This hour, we'll explore how siblings shape us and how we shape them. We'll talk about birth order, gender, twins, only children, sibling conflict, sibling support, and how our relationships change over time. We also want to hear from you this hour. Share your stories. How have your siblings shaped you? How have your relationships changed? You can call us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We also have people tweeting their favorite sibling pictures at IPR Talk this hour. And my guest is Jeffrey Kluger. He's the author of The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in the introduction to your book, you write about how these are the relationships that really are the constants in our life. Our parents tend to pass away before we do. Our partners, our children come along late in the game, but siblings are there, if we're lucky, for the duration, right?
That's exactly right. And it's important that not only are siblings with us for the entire ride, as you say, if we're lucky, from essentially cradle to grave, that includes the fact that they are with us through our formative years. They're with us when our social software, our emotional software, is still being booted up. And since they're there in those primal stages, they're also the people who help write those lines of code. They're the people who teach us about how to resolve conflicts, how to avoid conflicts, how to be entrusted with confidences, the wages of breaking those confidences. We learn about sharing. We learn about empathy. We learn about the opposite gender. If you're a boy growing up with a sister or you're a girl growing up with a brother, you learn a whole lot by getting those peaks inside the opposite gender's mind. So these are the people who essentially are the ones with whom we test drive life before we have to go out and live it. And in that sense, our siblings are our greatest trainers, and we are their greatest trainers.
And it's fascinating that, you know, so many books are written about parenting. So many blogs are dedicated to parenting. Right. We're all looking for ways to be better parents. But the idea of how much impact siblings have on each other is not something that we really explore that often.
No, it isn't. And I wrote my first of three cover stories in Time on this. Well, now it feels like a while ago, in 2006. Then that was just on siblings in general. Then I wrote another one on birth order the following year. And in 2011, when my book came out, we had a cover story on favoritism. But right about that period, in 2005, 2006, I started seeing a lot of research percolating up in the journals. And in fact, one terrific journal I've often turned to, the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, devoted an entire issue to siblings. And that was a real wake-up call, at least for me, and I think for a lot of people out there. As I say in the book, you know, it's a little bit like the old idea that before Pluto existed, astronomers believed that it had to exist because there were gravitational perturbations in Neptune's orbit that couldn't be explained otherwise. Social psychologists found something very similar with sibling relationships. Once they had studied parents, once they had studied grandparents, once they had studied the influence of teachers and of friends on shaping us, there was still some sort of temperamental dark matter that wasn't accounted for. And once they began looking at siblings, they realized this was it. And the research really took off after that.
Now, I think that it's possible that in addition to the research being very compelling, that this caught your eye also for a personal reason, because you are one of four brothers and your family is even more complicated than that. But tell us a little bit about your nuclear family, you and your brothers.
Well, my nuclear family is, it's four boys, and we were all born very close. We were born, the biggest gap is between my older brother and myself, and we're 23 months apart. The other ones are basically a year after that.
Wow.
So we're the same gender, very close in age, and that age makes a difference, because when you're, you know, 2 and 6, well, that's a developmental universe. That's a huge period of growth. But when you're, you know, 32 and 36, it makes almost no difference at all. So as we grew up, the 4-year gap between the oldest and youngest, as a function, as a share of our overall age, shrank and shrank as a percentage of our age and as a percentage of our developmental stages. As a result, we started off close and, I believe, grew closer and closer as we grew up. It certainly helped being the same gender, because we had similar interests and played similar games and went to similar movies, you know, and that brought us even closer. As I also write extensively in the book, my family was, you know, not the most highly functional family in the world, so multiple divorces, as siblings often find, drive the sibling bond closer together, or drive the siblings closer together, because the parents are supposed to be the executive relationship in the family. They are really the corner office of the family. And when that breaks apart, the kids tend to gravitate toward one another, seeking that kind of security, seeking that kind of strength. This turns up in lots and lots of studies about siblings, and it was certainly true in our case as we were growing up.
And really, I mean, divorce is a huge adversity for children. Any kind of adversity seems to bring that team idea together, that you are together against the world.
Well, that's exactly right. And there was one study, and I wish I remembered the acronym for it, but it was something like the TII, the Total Immersion Index, or something like that. And it was some study of siblings in particular, but also other people who are other relatives who are deeply, wholly immersed in one another's lives, and not in a dysfunctional way, in a good way. And when these researchers looked at sibling groups who crossed that TII threshold, suggesting very, very close, very intimate relationships, the siblings were interviewed and they were asked, what is it? Was there a threshold point? Was there a hinge point in your relationship that brought you closer? And in almost all cases, it was adversity of some kind. It was a job loss. It was economic difficulties. It was a death in the family, an illness in the family, something like that. But the one that came up the most often, not the majority, but the plurality, was divorce. That was the one that again and again showed up in studies. And again, I think there's no bad guy in the case of an illness or a death. I mean, there's a bad agency. The illness and the death itself are bad things, but there's no bad guy. But when the parents have, as they said in The Right Stuff, screwed the pooch, when they have been unable to hold their relationship together, the siblings tend to look for toward one another and say, all right, they botched the job, but we won't do that.
Right. And scientists and researchers have found that even when parents handle the divorce as well as it can possibly be handled,
right,
there's still this sort of crucible effect.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, parents can misbehave badly in divorce, and some parents can actually behave extraordinarily well. They can make it very clear to the kids that this has nothing to do with you, you did nothing wrong. They can make it very clear to the kids that mommy and daddy still like each other a lot and we're still friends, but we just don't think we love each other enough. And they can make it clear that we are going to work as hard as we ever did to bring you kids up together. It'll just be in two different houses. Even with all that, it's still existentially jolting to a child, because as long as you've been born into a two-parent household, as long as that's what you came into the world knowing and grew up at least a little bit knowing, it's the central pivot point of your life has broken in half, and there's no way around it. Now, obviously, parents who misbehave, who fight with one another, who criticize one another to the children. They make it worse and worse and worse, and paradoxically may drive the siblings closer and closer together.
Well, and there are so many different aspects of our sibling relationships that I want to talk about this hour. And one of the ways that we seem to shape each other as siblings is because, of course, we each need attention. We're each seeking attention in the world. We each need our own identity. And so if we have a sibling that has filled one niche, we may fill another, even if we're very similar people, right?
That's exactly right. And it's called identification or de-identification. So if my older brother had been captain of the high school football team, and I assure you he wasn't, he and I were both terrible athletes, but if he had been, I could go in one of two directions. I could say, wow, look at all the attention he gets. Look at all the validation he gets for doing that. I'm going to do that too. Well, even if I do exactly as well as he did and become captain of the football team myself, I'm still only getting 50% of the reward and attention in the household for that particular skill. In the alternative, I could say, you know what, I'm going to run for student council president, or I'm going to take up the flute and earn 100% of the attention for being the socially active, it's the social activist child or the musician child. So kids go in different directions. Now, look, we have, you know, I just recently wrote about this on our Time.com parenting site. There are object lessons in when this works well and when it doesn't work well. Peyton and Eli Manning, well, it's, you know, it's been great for sports fans that they followed the same path and identified with each other because they both got Super Bowl rings. On the other hand, Cal Ripken, the Hall of Famer, and, you know, his little brother Billy Ripken, who made it to the major leagues and was a serviceable player, but he was kind of a journeyman, and he developed something of a bad boy reputation. And, you know, one wonders whether he would have done a better job with his life had he not chosen to identify with his brother. On the other hand, de-identification, choosing something different, can work and not work. Look at the Emmanuel brothers, Rahm Emanuel and Ari Emanuel and Ezekiel Emanuel. One is mayor of Chicago. One is a doctor of medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and one is a high-powered Hollywood agent. So de-identification worked well in their case. One example of de-identification not working well is Neil Bush. You know, he's not quite the black sheep of the Bush family, but he's certainly the dark gray sheep, and maybe he would have done better if he had followed the family's lead and gone into public service as well.
Jeffrey, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about our sibling relationships today. My guest is Jeffrey Kluger, author of The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. He's also the editor-at-large for Time Magazine and Time.com, and his most recent book is The Narcissist Next Door. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
I remember when you first came home, then came another little brother of our own. Even when you break my toys, you
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about our relationships with our siblings, how they shape us, how we shape them. Of course, many of us are also parenting siblings or have parented siblings. You are welcome to join the conversation this hour. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. How have your siblings shaped you? You can also tweet us at IPRTop. And we're asking people to tweet us some of their favorite pictures of them with their siblings this hour as well. So you can take a look at those at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour is Jeffrey Kluger. He's the author of The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. And we were talking before the break about how when there are more siblings, we either identify with our siblings or we de-identify and fill a different niche. Let's talk about birth order, because that really does seem to have a strong impact on who we become. Although, I mean, obviously there are exceptions to every rule, but let's talk about that oldest child.
Well, the oldest, first, just a something on birth order in general. One of the things that's so fascinating about birth order in general is, as one of the scientists I spoke to, the fact that it's something lay people came to even before the scientists did. It seemed intuitively obvious that birth order was a powerful driver of who we become. And in family after family, kids tend to fit that template of their birth order. Now, as you say, there are, you know, 1,000 exceptions to every rule, but very, very broadly, you find that kids tend to fall into those temperamental buckets that seem consistent with their birth order. In the case of the firstborn, you find kids who are more conservative, more serious about their life goals. They tend to be more committed to the family, more sort of focused on the structure of the family, the rules of the family. They tend to be closer to their parents, a little bit closer than their younger siblings are. They tend to be a bit more risk averse. So even when you see, say, two brothers, for example, who play the same sport, say they both play baseball, the firstborn is likelier to be in the low impact positions like an outfielder or a first baseman, as opposed to, say, a catcher, which is a real physical contact part of the sport. So they tend to be, they may be very aggressive and ambitious, but they tend also to be risk averse. They make more conservative CEOs also than other siblings do. Now, this is because firstborns come into the world and they land in a flower bed. They get a very sweet deal from birth. Remember, we are all hardwired to want to get the greatest number of goodies from our parents. And the reason is obvious, because our parents have only so many minutes, dollars, or calories they can invest in any child in the course of a given day, and never mind the course of an entire childhood. So every dollar, calorie, and minute that goes to you as, say, my big sister is one that's subtracted from me as the kid brother. So we immediately become very competitive about that. Well, the firstborn gets a head start on food, gets a head start on attention, gets a head start on language, gets a head start on love. And when by the time the younger child comes along, you get what corporations call sunk costs. The parents have already poured a lot into this first product coming off the assembly line. So if they were going to cancel one product, you know, the iPhone 4, as soon as it was coming out, Apple had invested a lot in it. If somebody had a prototype of the iWatch coming along and Apple needed to cut back somewhere, they'd say, let's hold the iWatch. We're almost ready to launch this iPhone. Well, you know, it's cold and mechanistic, but the same thing is true about parents of firstborns. So firstborns do whatever they can to preserve the existing system. As I said in a different piece I just wrote for Time.com, they're sort of the monarchists of the family, as opposed to the other siblings who are more the Republicans. And I mean that in the lowercase r way. They're more the ones who, you know, they don't want a monarchy. They want a democracy.
Right, because they're the heir apparent, the oldest child.
Exactly.
So they want to continue that monarchy.
That's exactly right.
Now, I think it's easiest then to talk about youngest children next, because the middle is an interesting territory as well.
Yeah, the middle is. And I mean, it actually says something about the middle child that whenever people talk about firstborn, about birth order, they always go first to the oldest, then the youngest. And then they say, oh, we still got a few minutes. All right, let's talk about the middle child. And that's what everyone does. The youngest comes into the world with a single goal, which is, unlike the oldest, is to upset the existing system. So the youngest tend to be rebels. The youngest tend to be, if the big brother is going to law school, the little brother is going to be an artist. If the big brother goes to a demonstration and demonstrates peacefully, the younger child is likelier to be the one who gets arrested. And there's actually a real study that shows this.
Yeah, I read that in your book. That was really striking.
Really quite remarkable. If, you know, the big brother is the one who's going to be a surfer, the little brother is the one who's going to be an extreme sport bungee jumper or something. Because what they're doing is trying to change things. They're trying to radicalize things. There's another interesting study that showed regarding that CEO thing, that if two siblings are CEOs, if a firstborn takes over a struggling company, the firstborn will do a better job of fixing things, streamlining things, making sure the trains run on time. The later born is much likelier to blow up the tracks and lay entirely new ones and start all over. Now, both strategies may work wonderfully well depending on the company and depending on what's needed, but clearly first and last borns are likelier to approach it in different ways. An advantage of the firstborn, of the lastborn rather, is that they develop what's known as a theory of mind earlier. It's the idea that, you know, knowing that what's in your head is not the same thing as in my head. There's an adorable study of toddlers that show that if a caregiver, a babysitter, or an adult is in a room with a toddler and hides a toy, and the toddler is aware of the toy that's been hidden, the toddler, at least if they're old enough to have some language, will assume that anyone who walks in the room later will also know where the toy is hidden, because toddlers assume that all knowledge is universal knowledge. In some ways, that's a very narcissistic thing, because what I know must be the same knowledge the whole world has. Nobody can know anything that's more or less or different from what I know. It's only when kids get to be around 3 years old that they begin to fully appreciate, oh, wait, you know things I don't. I know things you don't. We need to share. We need to collaborate. We need to communicate like this. Lastborns tend to develop that theory of mind earlier than firstborns do, and mostly it's because of survival. Because if you're the smallest person in the playroom, you're the likeliest one to get slugged, and you are the least able to defend yourself. So it's you have to develop early the ability to read somebody's mood, read somebody's body language, and know, I better duck the punch that's coming. Similarly, they tend to be funnier. Now, this is partly, again, because they take a more perverse, more iconoclastic view of the world, but it's also because it's being funny is a very powerful low-power strategy. It's very hard to hit somebody who's making you laugh. So kids learn to defend themselves and disarm with humor, which is why, say, Stephen Colbert is the youngest of 11 children, and why you see all down the line Flaubert and Twain and a lot of light satirists or comedians have been later born or last borns in their families.
Now, I would guess that some of those traits that youngest children develop also would be things that middle children would also develop, because, of course, they are little mini sociologists, too. They're watching their older sibling and trying to figure out how the world works. They're also trying to get attention, which is even harder for a middle child, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's what's interesting, because middle children are youngest children for a little while, just like oldest children are only children for a little while. You know, I was the second born. I've never been an only child. My older brother was for 23 months. I was the baby of the family for 13 months or 15 months until my little brother Gary came along. So what happens is you start off as the baby in the family. You start off as the one being protected. You start off as the one developing a better theory of mind. You start off doing all the things that youngest children will do. But when a new baby comes along, suddenly your early training is redirected, and suddenly you need some of those younger child skills in order to deal with your older brother and the adults in your life, but suddenly you also have some dominant stuff going on with your little brother, so you need different kinds of skills. You need mentoring skills, for one thing, which is, you know, that's kind of a sweet and nice part of being an older brother. You also begin wrestling with the fact that whether or not parents admit it, they devote more attention to the oldest and the youngest. The oldest, again, because he or she is the heir or heiress apparent, and the costs have been sunk into that person. And the youngest, because the baby needs the most attention, needs the most help, and also, and you know, this is hard science, even if it doesn't feel like it. The baby is just so bloody cute. We are suckers for neoteny. We are suckers for baby-like features and baby-like behavior. And you see it when people walk into a room and there are a bunch of children there. Your eye always goes to the little baby in his mother's arms with a bottle or breast in his mouth, because he's just so adorable and delicious looking. So, you know, the parents are exactly as vulnerable to that kind of thing as kids are. And as a result, the second born, who was once the last born, suddenly sees the attention drifting a little bit. So, you know, you develop some of the neuroses and some of the issues that a middle child tends to develop.
Absolutely. I'm talking with Jeffrey Kluger. He is the author of The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. He's also the editor-at-large for Time Magazine and Time.com. You're welcome to join our conversation this hour, 866-780-9100. And Jeffrey, you have this wonderful description when you're writing about middle children. Of course, you were a middle child. Your brother Gary was also a middle child. And you describe Gary as the white sheep of the family.
That's exactly right. And I wish I had coined it. Someone else, another relative did. And Gary is, he's the nice one. He's the sweet one. He's not the difficult one. He's not the diva my older brother is, or the blowhard I became, or the wild child Bruce the baby became. He's just, he's a good guy. I swear, he's never had a bad picture taken of him in his life. And I think that's just because he's got such equanimity and, you know, such a good soul that it radiates in his pictures. You know, I get nothing but bad pictures taken of me because I'm, you know, cranky and difficult. So Gary has been and was and has always been the most amenable child, the easiest child. My mother used to say that when he was born, if he could have gotten out of his crib and gotten his own bottle, he would have done it. And he would have said, don't trouble yourself. I'll handle it. That is part of the middle child thing.
And it doesn't always happen that way.
No, it doesn't always happen that way. But you try to be accommodating. You try to be well-liked. You try to be well-regarded and to receive some of the same kinds of attention the first and last born get. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that you're not in general, again, very broad rules, you're not going to get that. So middle children do tend to end up with greater senses of insecurity. When adults are studied for self-esteem issues, there's a slightly higher tendency for middle children to have self-esteem issues because they were never the prince or the princess or the heir apparent. They tend to take a little bit longer to find a career as well. They tend to drift a little bit more. And this, I think, is mostly because they weren't celebrated and feted for all of their accomplishments in babyhood. You know, if you, at 2 years old, show a facility with a crayon and everybody just gushes over you, and for your whole life you're told you're going to be a great artist, well, you're a little more inclined to be nudged in that direction than if you're the slightly older sibling and you draw a nice picture and everyone says that's wonderful, but it doesn't get the kind of fawning attention the first or the last born get. So they do tend to drift a little bit more before they find their way. Two other things that happen relative to family. Middle children do tend to be the ones that are less invested in family later in life. They tend to be the ones who, they'll be happy to come to mom's and dad's 50th anniversary party, and they'll, you know, they may deeply love their parents, but they're definitely not going to be the ones to organize it. They'll be happy to look at the family photo albums or at the family videos, but they're not going to be the one who does all that cataloging and goes through the shoe boxes and saves everything. That's just not what middle children tend to do. That's not such a great thing because they do get a little more distant from family. One of the upsides, though, of being the middle child is that they do tend to develop bigger and denser and richer and broader social circles. They tend to have better support groups and a better network of people outside the family. And again, that's simply adaptive. That's
right. They need it.
Right. You're not getting it as well at home, so you do it much better in the outside world. Now, nobody is really aware of why you're doing it, but, you know, we all know it's any sense of satiation. You know when you're full. You know when you've had enough to eat, whether it's literally or emotionally. And when you've had enough, you push away from the table. When you haven't, you go out looking for a little more. So middle children tend to go looking for a little more.
Now, one of the things that parents least like to talk about that you write about in your book and research has looked into is favoritism.
Exactly.
Parental favoritism, which really influences siblings a lot.
Absolutely influences siblings a lot. And I like to say every parent in the world has a favorite, with a single exception of my wife and myself.
I'm going to have to jump on that bandwagon. Me too.
Right, exactly. Because the hard rule is parents on pain of death will not admit it. My mother, who's now in her mid-80s, once a few years ago, I was talking about mentioning something about an evening my youngest brother had a talent show at school, and I sat in the audience glowering the whole time. And she said, why? Because he was my favorite? And I said, aha, you finally said it. And her response was, I have no idea what you're talking about. And she's been denying it her whole life. But the fact is, you can't not have a favorite. It does not mean parents love any child more than any other child. And if there were a way to quantify that, you would probably find that on the Geiger counter of love, all the kids register at exactly the same level. But it's impossible for you not to say, I enjoy this person's company more. I feel more simpatico with this person. I feel I can speak in a kind of shorthand to child B that I can't to child A or C. It has nothing to do with love. It has everything to do with the natural variations in human relationships and the fact that, you know, we're always going to click better with some people than others. One of the things that I include in the book is the dyad formula. You know, every house includes a certain number of people, but there are many, many more dyads, one-on-one relationships in the house. You know, in a four-person family, there are six dyads: mom's and dad's relationship with each other, mom's relationship with child A, mom's relationship with child B, dad's relationship with A and B, and the kids' relationship with each other. Those are six pairs. Once you get up to a family like Bobby Kennedy's, which had 12 children, there are 91 dyads.
Wow. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Jeffrey Kluger. He's the editor-at-large for Time Magazine and Time.com. He's also the author of The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
When a certain gentleman arrived from Rome, she wore the dress and I stayed home. Of weather, we stick together, the same in the rain or sun. Two different faces, but in tight places, we think and we act as one. Those who've seen us know that not a thing could come between us. Many men have tried to split us up, but no one can. Lord help the mister who comes between me and my sister.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about sibling relationships. My guest is Jeffrey Kluger. He's the author of The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. And we were talking about favoritism before the break, but let's turn the subject a little bit to some of the variety in different families. And we have an email from Carolyn in Iowa City who brings this up very well. She says, my brothers were 16 and 18 years old when I was born. At 68, I still debate if my brothers loved, resented, were jealous of me, or some other feeling. What typically happens in families with long gaps in age?
Well, the answer to your caller's question is probably yes to all of those things. Now, I'm sure that her brothers loved and love her, but there is a very complicated set of emotions that play out when there is a much younger child who comes along, partly because kids are, again, no matter how late in life it goes, you still want to be the one who's the focus of your parents' attention. You want to be the one who has found a niche and is getting the rewards that you think you deserve. Well, by 16 and 18, you're in a system that either works or doesn't work, but it's a familiar system, and you do not want someone to come along and upset it. If a child suddenly comes along who is 16 or 18 years your junior, that turns everything on its head. Now, that doesn't have to be a bad thing. You know, a friend of my older daughter, who's now 14, she used to, a friend that you knew from kindergarten, was, you know, 5 years old, and her older brothers were 22 and 24. She was born when they were already in their late teens, exactly this situation. And I used to see them come to school and pick her up. And I spoke to her parents when I was writing this book, and they said, well, yeah, the boys were definitely conflicted when the little sister came along. One of them was kind of excited about it. One of them was completely indifferent about it, which is, you know, fairly consistent with adolescence or late adolescence, which is where they were. But they developed a relationship that was equal parts brother to sister and uncle to niece. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've lost track of this girl a little bit now, but, you know, at this point, she's 14 and her brothers are in their late 20s, or maybe even one of them has reached 30. So I don't know exactly how that's shaken out. But as she was growing up, they would sort of toggle back and forth between uncle, niece, brother, sister. all of those relationships can be wonderful. My brother Bruce had was the first one to have a baby. He was the first one to become a father, and I just adored having a little niece, but well before I had kids. So, you know, these kids can, I mean, they get the best of both worlds. You have a little sister who has all the intimacy in some ways of a sister, but also looks up to you and adores you the way a niece can an uncle. So these things aren't necessarily bad.
Well, and even smaller gaps, like 4 or 5 years, can have a really big impact in that whole influence of the birth order thing as well, right?
Well, that's exactly right. Because again, you know, in my case, in my family's case, we were almost as close as you can get without bumping up against the
right
length of gestation. And that helped us a lot. But the further out you go, the greater the difference is in developmental stages. And, you know, you'll see there, again, in my family, there may not have been all that much developmental difference between Steve and me, and then Steve down to, then me down to Gary, and then Gary down to Bruce. But there was a big difference between number one and number four. They wouldn't be moving in the same circles when they were in school. They wouldn't be interested in the same things at the same time. This can sometimes, this proximity in age can sometimes lead to trouble. I have a chapter in the book devoted to risk behavior, things like drinking and drugs and teen pregnancy and even
criminality. Seem to be very contagious among siblings.
Very contagious among siblings. And, you know, the numbers, I forget what the exact numbers are, but I think it's like a younger sibling whose older brother smokes or older sibling smokes has a 4 times greater chance of picking up the habit as well. It's twice as much for drinking. I forget. Don't have the number for drugs off the top of my head. And depending on the family, it can be 6 times the risk for a little sister whose big sister becomes a teen mom. When there's an age gap, that's a bit protective because, again, if I'm 16 and my older brother is 18 and that 2 years is exactly where we were and he's moving with his friends and he has cigarettes and they have cigarettes, I'm much likelier to bump into his social circle and help myself to whatever substances they're using than if he's 16 or if he's 18 and I'm 8. I'm just not going to be interacting with his circle as much. So I have a better chance of making it through my childhood without ever having encountered drugs or alcohol or cigarettes.
Now, what about twins?
Twins are...
Or multiples, I guess.
Or multiples. Well, you mentioned earlier that I've had a whole mix of sibling relationships. My mother was married a second time briefly, and we had 2 stepsisters for about 15 months. And my father got remarried, and he and his wife had twins about 10 years after I was born. So I have a half brother and a half sister, and we became exceedingly close, which was, you know, the odds of that weren't great given all the family craziness and the age gap, but, you know, it's a blessing that we did. So I interviewed my sister a little bit more than my brother for this book. And they say what most twins say, which is that the connection between the two of them, when you've shared a womb, you clearly have no conscious memory of it, but there's no way of quantifying what behavioral differences are laid down, what software codes are written when you know one another from that early. And certainly when you're born together, you know one another's sound, you know one another's scent, you know one another's behavior. This is all imprinted on you like a baby gosling looking at her mother goose for the first time. So siblings tend to grow up to be, or twins tend to grow up to be exceedingly close, to lean on one another very closely, to value one another closely. When it's a boy and a girl, like my brother and sister, they can adopt a very sweet mother-son sort of thing. My little sister says she was always the one who had to get my little brother up for school in the morning because he never would have gotten out. And she was the one who always said, you know, it's 13 degrees out. You really can't wear just shirt sleeves today. You got to put a coat on. When it's identical twins, they're even closer because they're temperamentally so similar. And one study I looked at said that the grieving that a twin goes through later in life when another twin dies can actually be more severe than the loss of a spouse can be, even among people, between people who've been married for a very long time. Now, you hear all of these, you know, the Minnesota twin studies of twins who have these remarkable, even somehow seemingly supernatural similarities when they're separated at birth, and yet, you know, both became firemen, or both became funny, or both became, you know, there was some really strange details like, you know, two twins who both like to make jokes in elevators just to make other people laugh. Well, you know, this seems like strange behavioral coincidences. But in fact, you know, as much as I'd love it to be supernatural and spiritual, you can actually reduce it to genes. When we're born, we're born with certain temperamental templates. If you have an identical twin, you're born with identical temperamental templates. That means if you're born with a language sense, if you're born with a whimsy sense, if you're born with an iconoclastic sense, you're going to be likelier to make jokes. And if you also are born with a sense of high energy, the kind of person who needs the stimulation of a city, and some people are born with a high idol, some people are born with a low idol, if you're born with that high idol, you're likelier to live in a city, which means you're likelier to be in elevators more. So you have these two personality variables that at least have a better chance of bumping up against each other than if you don't have that same genetic template.
Right. Well, and so on the other hand, we have only children, and an increasing number of only children in our culture, as families tend to get smaller and smaller, it seems like they would have the best of everything that their parents have to offer, which is great, but they really do miss out on a lot of things that siblings have to offer us, right?
Right. Well, yes and no. Now, here's the thing. One of the cases I had to make when I was writing this book is that the book requires people to hold two seemingly contradictory thoughts in their head at the same time. It's a real sense of cognitive dissonance because, on the one hand, the case the book makes is that there is nothing as empowering, as civilizing, as emotionally nourishing, and as educational for you as having a sibling. And the other thought is, and if you don't have a sibling, you'll do just fine. And yet those things are true. Because when you look at studies, single children, only children, do tend to have sharper, more adult senses of humor. They tend to be better read. They tend to have better vocabularies. They tend to be better students. They tend to be almost as good, and it's just almost statistically insignificant, at social intuitiveness as kids with siblings are. They tend to integrate as well as kids with siblings do in classrooms and in workplaces and so forth. Now, this all contradicted all of the earlier thinking that only children would grow up as narcissistic and selfish and grandiose and all of the things that you think you're going to get when you're raising a little prince or princess. There's somebody I quote who said, somebody, I forget his name now, at the beginning of the 20th century, who said, being an only child is itself an emotional disorder. And it's clearly not the case. Because what happens, and this is especially so now, is that attentive parents do a very good job of giving kids that socialization in other ways, after school activities and cousins and sport groups and, you know, all manner, summer camp. You get that kind of peer socialization in all kinds of other ways. At the same time you're getting that, you also are developing a quieter, more self-contained sense, an ability to sit with yourself and think and create and do the things that kids with siblings who are in this constant storm of activity don't necessarily get to do. I could never have a moment of quiet reflection or deep thought when I was a child because it was, you know, my house was a free fire zone. And in some cases, I mean that in a good way. It was a lot of fun. But when you're an only child, I have a dear friend who grew up as an only child and is raising an only child. And he and his son both play guitar beautifully. And he said, you know, I will see Matthew in his room playing guitar. And he's exactly the way I was when I was his age. I could just get lost in it for a long time. I could be very self-contained. And it's the reason I learned to play it so well. And his son is the same way. That wouldn't have been quite the same if there had been another sibling in the house.
I want to talk more about gender among siblings and how that influences us. But we also have a question from a listener. This is from Mary. She says, we adopted two children. One was 19 months old. One was 28 months old. How does this fit into the sibling patterns when they entered the family at the same time? They're now both 17, at least for a few more days.
Well, that's a very good question. And a part of it depends on how old they are when they enter the family. If one is 16 and one is 14, kids typically aren't adopted that old, but let's say 5 and 3, as opposed to, you know, when you're still numbering things in months, you've got the clay is softer when you're still numbering things in months. So they will tend to take on still those first and later born attributes, simply because no matter the fact that they come into the family at the same time, the older child still gets certain kinds of privileges. The older child still has certain kinds of responsibilities. The younger child still is the one who's pampered and adored in different ways. The younger child is still, again, the one who's a little more neotenous, a little more baby-like and precious than the older child is. So there is differential treatment. Now, you're right that there isn't that same sense of sunk costs, you know. If it's just like with twins, twins are born at the same time. You haven't invested, you know, more in one than you have in the other. So, you know, they start off equal in that sense. Well, here the age may be different, but the investment of time and energy won't be the same. So that variable will be taken out of that birth order sequence. But still, the idea that certain privileges, certain responsibilities, certain senses of whether we want it or want to admit it or not, the heir apparent and, you know, the crazy princeling afterwards, you know, these things will still play out in a family in which kids of different age are adopted at the same time.
Now, before we run out of time, you grew up in a pack of boys, mm-hmm. and I know that some girls entered into that equation later on. I'm the youngest of three. I'm the only girl, and I feel that I've given my brothers a great deal just by being born. And you write about that.
You absolutely have. Look, as I say it, I forget if I say it in the book or I said it at one point on the radio. I mean, girls in the house were such a mystery to me. I didn't even know what one ate. I had no idea how they played, how they talked, how they thought. They were in my classroom. But, you know, once kids begin to segregate by gender, that circle closed to me, and I got no peek behind that wall until, you know, I came back into the world when genders come back together in junior high and high school. So it was difficult for me because I was only in my 20s when I was already in my 20s when I got to know my little sister Allison, and the other two girls weren't with us very long. But what studies tend to show is that it's a fascinating study I like to talk about in the book, that college students who either did or did not have opposite sex siblings were paired together in sort of 5-minute speed dates. And this was all done, you know, as a psychology study. But the people they were talking to, the boy or the girl, man or woman opposite the table, they didn't know what that person's sibling relationship was. They didn't know if they had siblings. They didn't know what the gender of their siblings was. And then after all of these pair-ups were done, they were interviewed about how they connected with the person opposite the table. And almost uniformly, girls who had brothers were rated as funnier, as more relaxed, as a little more, a little less conventional by boys, as willing to say more risque things. Boys who had sisters were rated as more sensitive, as doing better at making eye contact, at asking questions more, which is a very highly valued skill when boys are on the dating market. And this is all because, whether you know it or not, cross-sex siblings socialize one another in the ways of the other sex's mind. If I have a sister, I have to learn how to turn the tumblers in a girl's mind in the same way that I have to learn how to turn the tumblers in a boy's mind. But I kind of know my own mind, so I kind of know what boys like. I need that training from a girl, and a girl needs the same training from a boy. Now, obviously, if you don't have opposite sex siblings, you can get out into the world and learn pretty quickly what's going to get you dates and what isn't and what the opposite sex likes and doesn't like. But you do have a bit of a head start when you have an opposite sex sib.
Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Jeffrey Kluger is the author of The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. He's also the editor-at-large for Time Magazine and Time.com. His most recent book is The Narcissist Next Door. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.